Imagine you're walking into this incredibly sterile boardroom.
Oh, intimidating right off the bat.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And sitting across the table is this notoriously cynical television producer. Like, this is a person whose entire job, literally their whole career, is to spot the strings, find the flaws, and just tear pitches apart before the coffee even gets cold.
Yeah, the kind of guy who's seen it all.
Exactly. And he looks at you and says, just completely flatly, I hate mentalism. I hate magic. You have exactly 3 minutes to impress me.
Wow, no pressure.
Right. What do you even do? Well, if you're Peter Turner, you don't, you know, pull out a deck of cards. You don't use gadgets. You use this highly engineered, totally invisible web of linguistics and psychology to perform a routine called the Midas Touch.
And it works.
It more than works. 3 minutes later, that exact same cynical producer is basically losing his mind. He's calling it the most fresh, impossible thing he's ever seen, and he practically hands Turner a television deal on the spot.
That is just wild.
It really is. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we've got a massive stack of sources in front of us. We are pulling apart a highly guarded manuscript by Peter Turner himself, alongside our own research notes on tactile memory, cognitive load, and the psychology of suggestibility.
It's a heavy stack today.
Yeah, it is. And our mission today is to completely deconstruct this legendary routine. We're going to explore the architecture of what is essentially a psychological miracle, and we're going to strip away the mystery to show you the actual machinery underneath.
And, you know, it's such a fascinating piece of literature to dig into, primarily because Turner kept this routine incredibly close to his chest for, I mean, about 8 years.
8 years? Why?
Yeah. He only shared the actual mechanic, the linguistic subtleties we're going to dissect today, with his absolute closest circle of friends.
Right.
So it's rare that we get this level of unvarnished access to a working professional's absolute best, like, reputation-making material.
That makes sense. And he had a very specific vision for the book itself, right?
Yeah, he did. He originally designed the physical booklet to be this homage to classic mentalism texts of the past, specifically Theodore Annemann's Demon Productions.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he wanted it to feel like you were uncovering this dusty, forbidden tome of secrets. And honestly, just looking through these pages, it genuinely reads like a masterclass in hijacking human perception.
It really does. And I want to contextualize just how potent this routine is because, frankly, that TV producer story isn't even the most intimidating room Turner has performed this in.
No, not by a long shot.
There's an anecdote in the text that sets the stakes perfectly. So picture this. It's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Turner is sitting in this Indian restaurant in Bradford, and he is surrounded by a group of elite, highly respected performers. We're talking people like Steve Harrison, Jared Manley, Mark Shando.
These are heavy hitters.
Exactly. These are not easily fooled lay people. These are professional deceivers. They're sitting around jamming, sharing ideas about what the industry calls PK touches, which is the illusion of touching someone from a distance.
All right. Telekinesis, essentially.
Right. So Turner stands up, performs an early version of this Midas touch routine, finishes, and sits down. And the response from the table is just, it's dead silence.
Because crickets.
Literally nothing for 15 full seconds.
And to really understand the weight of that silence, you have to put yourself in the mindset of those specific performers.
Right, because they know how it all works.
Exactly. When you know every trick, every invisible thread, every hidden gimmick in the book, your brain is constantly running this background program trying to solve whatever you're watching.
Yeah, they're reverse engineering it in real time.
So if you can leave a table of top-tier mentalists in stunned silence for 15 full seconds, you haven't just fooled their eyes. You have completely short-circuited their analytical frameworks.
That is insane.
Turner actually writes about how, with a knot in his stomach, those 15 seconds felt like a geological age.
I bet.
But when they finally broke the silence, they all simultaneously flipped over how clean, how flawlessly beautiful the construction of the routine was.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can tear down the walls and see the plumbing, we really need to walk through the house.
Good analogy.
Let's look at the pure, unadulterated effect, exactly as a neutral audience member would experience it. If you or I were sitting in the crowd, what is the visual evidence our brains are processing?
Okay, so the setup is visually stark and entirely transparent.
Keep it simple.
Right. The performer brings a participant forward from the audience and has them sit in a single chair facing the crowd. Let's call this person the seated participant.
Okay, got it.
The performer asks them to close their eyes and then actively, physically proves to the entire room that this person cannot see anything.
So there's no peeking.
None.
Yeah.
The performer stresses to the participant how crucial it is that their eyes remain completely shut for the duration of the experiment.
So right out of the gate, we have an isolated, blindfolded subject, no visual input whatsoever.
Precisely. From there, the performer physically walks away. They move a deliberate 5 to 6 feet away from the seated participant and approach a second person sitting in the audience.
Okay, establishing distance.
Yeah. And in full view of everyone, the performer openly taps the second person on the forehead. Immediately, the performer turns to the seated participant, the one with their eyes closed, 6 feet away, and asks if they felt anything.
And the seated participant verbally confirms that, yes, they just felt a tap on their forehead.
They do. And then it escalates from there.
Right.
The performer moves to a third person in the audience. The performer taps this third person twice on the arm, pauses for a few seconds to let the silence hang, and then taps them a third time.
A weird rhythm.
Very weird. Then the performer turns back to the blindfolded seated participant and asks what they felt.
And the seated participant says they felt 2 to 3 taps, which perfectly matches that weird stuttering cadence the performer just demonstrated.
Yes, exactly. Then the performer asks the seated participant to open their eyes, shake it off, relax for a second, and then snaps their fingers to put them back into that closed eye, trance-like state.
But still maintaining that 6-foot distance, right? The performer never approaches the chair.
The distance is rigorously, almost aggressively maintained.
Oh.
Finally, we reach the climax. The performer walks over to a fourth participant in the audience. They tap this fourth person firmly on the left shoulder blade.
Okay.
The performer calls out to the seated participant and asks if they felt anything. The seated participant confirms that they felt a tap and specifically notes, without prompting, that it was a firmer tap than the previous ones.
See, that detail is the hook for me. The change in pressure actually translates across the room.
It's totally inexplicable to the audience. And to provide the final visual proof, the performer asks the seated participant to physically point to exactly where they felt that last firm tap.
Let me guess.
Yep. The seated participant reaches back and points directly to their own left shoulder blade, the exact matching spot.
I mean, if I'm in the audience watching this unfold, I have no logical recourse. It really looks like genuine telekinesis.
It does.
It feels like watching a glitch in the Matrix where invisible forces are transferring physical sensations across an empty space. My immediate assumption is that there must be an earpiece or an accomplice or like some sort of vibrating mechanism in the chair.
Sure, that's where the brain goes.
So how do you achieve this without a hidden gadget?
Well, this is where we introduce the core mechanism of the entire piece. Turner acknowledges in the text that you could use a remote-controlled gimmick chair or invisible thread.
But he doesn't.
Right. He vastly prefers a completely covert physical method combined with an incredibly potent psychological architecture known as dual reality.
Dual reality? That sounds like a sci-fi concept, like, you know, editing two different movies together. How does that actually function in a performance setting?
In mentalism, dual reality is this structural framework where the audience and the participant on stage are experiencing two completely different non-intersecting timelines.
Wait, timelines?
Yeah, timelines and interpretations of the exact same event. They're both hearing the exact same words from the performer.
Okay.
But because their specific contexts have been manipulated beforehand, they walk away with two entirely different understandings of what just happened.
That's fascinating.
The illusion doesn't exist on the stage. It actually exists in the cognitive gap between those two realities.
That completely reframes how I look at magic. It's not about hiding a coin in your palm. It's about hiding an idea in someone's head.
That's exactly what it is.
So if the performer is building these two separate realities, where does the construction actually start? If we look at the sequence Turner lays out, before you even attempt to touch anyone, you have to establish absolute control over the environment, right?
Yeah, the very first foundational requirement is deceptively simple, but structurally vital. You absolutely must refer to the seated participant by their actual name.
Their name.
Yes. If their name is Sarah, you say, keep your eyes closed, Sarah.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second. What if you're nervous or just terrible with names and you forget it halfway through the routine? Can't you just say, did you feel that?
If you do that, the routine instantly collapses.
Instantly.
Instantly.
Yeah.
Think about the cognitive state of the participant. Their eyes are closed. They are in a room full of people.
Right.
If you just ask an open question like, did you feel that? They have no idea if you were talking to them, to someone else in the audience, or to the lighting guy.
Oh, true. They can't see who you're looking at.
Exactly. So they'll hesitate. They might ask, wait, me? And that split second of delay shatters the illusion of real-time telepathy.
Because telepathy should be instant.
Right. By anchoring every single question with their specific name, you guarantee an immediate reflexive response, which keeps the pacing razor sharp.
That makes total sense.
And if you know you are bad with names, Turner suggests giving them a highly specific title, like Player One, right from the start.
Okay, so it's all about minimizing cognitive friction for the participant. Now, what about the physical space? We establish the seated participant is 5 to 6 feet away, facing the audience, but Turner is incredibly dogmatic about where the secondary participant, the ones in the audience getting tapped, are positioned.
Oh, he's militant about it.
He insists they must be side on to the audience, never with their backs facing the crowd.
Yeah, visual clarity is the entire currency of this effect. If a participant has their back to the audience and you tap their forehead, the audience's view is obscured by the participant's own head.
Oh, right. Their big head is in the way.
Right. The audience might think, well, maybe he didn't tap it. Maybe he just waved his hand. You need the audience to see the physical impact of the tap with absolute, undeniable clarity.
So there's no ambiguity.
Exactly. So that when the seated participant verbally confirms it a millisecond later, the impact is visceral.
But reading through his staging requirements, I had a massive practical question.
What's that?
What if you are not in a theater? What if you are at a crowded networking event or like a tight pub and you are completely surrounded by people? You can't control sight lines in a 360-degree environment.
Turner addresses that head on with an absolute non-negotiable rule.
Mm-hmm.
He states he has never in his entire career performed surrounded.
Never.
Never. You must control the environment. If people are behind him, he politely asks them to move. He says, I am very mindful of moving myself and the attraction to a spot where I naturally have everyone facing what I want them to face.
I mean, it feels almost aggressive to walk into a room and start rearranging where people stand.
It might feel that way. But if we connect this to the broader psychology of authority, this isn't just about hiding secret moves from bad angles.
What is it about?
It is about establishing psychological dominance.
Mm.
Subtly moving people around a physical space asserts your authority in that situation. You become the director of the scene before the trick even begins.
Oh, wow. That totally connects back to the TV producer anecdote. Turner mentions that in high-stakes pitch meetings, he intentionally asks the head executive to move to a different seat. I thought that was just a quirky flex, but it's a calculated tactic.
It is a profound piece of behavioral psychology. Think about it. When an executive or any audience member commits to the physical action of moving at your request, they are subconsciously committing to your process.
They're following an order.
They have ceded a microscopic amount of territorial control to you. They are now operating within your framework.
If you're listening to this right now, think about how this applies to your next corporate negotiation or boardroom meeting.
Oh, absolutely.
If you walk in and gently direct where people sit or ask someone to shift down so you can use the whiteboard, you are subtly asserting dominance. You are framing yourself as the authority figure before you even present your first slide.
Exactly. You are dictating the terms of engagement. So we have the participant named, seated, distanced, and the environment visually controlled.
The foundation is set.
Right. Which brings us to the phase where the true mechanics of the illusion are secretly executed.
Right, because if you can't touch them later during the trick, you have to touch them now.
Yes.
This is the secret setup, the covert physical work. And Turner starts this with something he calls the pre-frame scripting.
Yeah, so before doing anything secret, the performer openly and deliberately taps the seated participant.
Just right out in the open.
Right out in the open. The performer taps them on the forehead and then taps them twice on the arm. And while executing these touches, the performer explicitly states, in a moment, I want you to remember everything you feel. Any sensations you get, remember. For example, if you feel me touching you here, tap on forehead, remember it. Or here, tap twice on the arm. I want you to remember what you feel from this point.
He puts massive emphasis on those three words, from this point. Why is the script so vital? Like, could you just skip it and go straight to the trick?
Turner actually shares that when he first started performing early iterations of this routine, he didn't use this script. He would do his secret touches, walk away, and ask the blindfolded person, did you feel me tap you? And sometimes the participant would just shrug and say no.
Oh, no. That is brutal. You are standing there on stage trying to be a mind reader, and your subject just flat out denies the premise. The trick is dead in the water.
It is catastrophic.
Yeah.
But let's look at what this revised pre-frame script actually does to the participant's brain.
Okay, let's break it down.
By explicitly telling them, I'm going to ask you about your feelings. Remember everything from this point. You are effectively telling them that a quiz is coming. The participant immediately transitions from a passive observer to an active archivist. They make a highly conscious effort to catalog every physical sensation they experience.
Plus, you have to factor in the social pressure, right?
Definitely.
You have their eyes closed. They know a room full of people is staring at them. If the performer asks the question later and they say, I don't know, they risk looking unobservant, stupid, or like they are intentionally ruining the show. It forces a state of hyper-awareness.
Furthermore, this script brilliantly patches a massive vulnerability for after the show.
Oh, because people talk.
Exactly. When the routine concludes, human nature dictates that audience members will rush up to the seated participant and interrogate them. They will ask, did he really touch you?
Right.
And because of the pre-frame, the participant will honestly say, yes, he touched my forehead, my arm, and my shoulder.
Wow.
They won't expose the method because they genuinely believe those overt practice touches were part of the magical effect, not a mundane setup.
It provides a perfectly constructed false memory for them to report back. That is brilliant.
It really is.
Okay, so the participant is primed. Now we move into the induction, where the secret touches actually happen. Turner uses a visual induction he calls the ball of light.
Right, so the performer stands near the seated participant and mimes holding a glowing, bouncy ball of light. They instruct the participant to visually track this imaginary ball upward, raising their gaze above their natural eye line.
Getting them to look up.
Yes. The performer says, I'm going to let go. Keep your eyes on it. When I snap my fingers, I want you to close your eyes and keep them closed. Don't open your eyes for any other reason than me saying open your eyes.
He is locking down the parameters again, closing the trap.
Yes. The performer snaps their fingers and the participant's eyes close. Now, the choreography must be flawlessly executed.
This is the scary part.
The performer shifts their position to the side of the seated participant. Specifically, the performer's chest must be perfectly aligned with the participant's left shoulder blade.
Let me picture the geometry here because this feels risky. He's standing parallel to her, his chest, her back. So from the audience's perspective, they see his profile.
Correct. The performer then takes their left hand, places it right in front of the participant's face, and addresses the audience, saying, it is essential that Sarah cannot see us.
Okay.
And while delivering this line, the performer leans forward slightly, waving that left hand past the participant's closed eyes.
And this is the exact moment the theft happens. But wait, if he's waving his left hand in front of her face, his right hand is just tapping her back, wouldn't the audience immediately see his right shoulder moving? If I'm watching a magic show, I'm looking for exactly that kind of unnatural movement.
You would think so, but this is where the biomechanics of misdirection come into play.
Okay, explain that.
When the performer raises their left hand to wave it in front of the face, that large sweeping movement naturally draws the audience's ocular focus. The human eye is hardwired to track the largest moving object in the frame.
Right, our eyes just go to the movement.
Simultaneously, the performer's chest and torso are acting as a physical wall, completely blocking the audience's line of sight to the participant's back.
So the physical action of tapping the back is entirely eclipsed by the body, while the audience's attention is magnetically pulled to the waving hand.
Exactly. And the tap itself isn't a random pat on the back. It is a highly specific vital sequence.
What's the sequence?
While the left hand waves, the right hand covertly applies two medium taps, followed immediately by one very firm tap to the left shoulder blade.
Two medium, one firm.
Yep.
And that is it. The physical work is officially 100% over. The overt taps on the forehead and arm are done, and the secret taps on the back are logged. From this second forward, the performer will never make physical contact with the seated participant again.
Never again.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the rest of this miracle relies entirely on weaponizing language.
We are transitioning from physical sleight of hand to verbal sleight of mind. This is where the dual reality is truly constructed through linguistic time shifting.
Let's trace the cognitive steps here. The performer has walked 6 feet away. The performer asks the seated person, keeping your eyes closed. You can tell by the sound of my voice that I'm not standing near or next to you now, right?
Right.
The participant agrees. Then the performer says, and I'm not touching you now. And the participant says no.
Notice the intense repetitive focus on the word now.
Yeah, he says it twice.
The performer is explicitly defining the present moment for the seated participant. establishing a baseline reality that, at this exact second, there is a physical void. No contact exists.
Then the performer turns, taps the second person in the audience on the forehead, and immediately pivots back to the seated person and asks, "But you did just feel me tap you?" And the seated person says, "Yes."
If you were the audience member, what would you assume the word "just" means in that sentence?
I would assume it means a millisecond ago, I literally just watched you tap someone and then you asked if they just felt it. The visual and the audio are perfectly synced in real time.
But let's shift to the internal reality of the seated participant. They have their eyes closed. They know you are 6 feet away. What does "just" mean to them?
Oh, I see. It has to mean the immediate past. They are scrolling back through their recent memory file. They remember the overt pre-frame taps from a minute ago. They remember you saying, "Remember if you feel me touching you here," and tapping their forehead. So when you ask, "But you did just feel me tap you," they locate that memory of the forehead tap and they say, "Yes."
It is a chronological shift. The audience and the participant are existing in two entirely different time zones.
That is wild.
The audience is operating in the present microsecond. The participant is reflecting on the events of the last 2 minutes. It is like watching a skilled politician dodge a question.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah, a journalist asks about a failing economic policy, and the politician answers by talking about a successful national security initiative. But they pepper their answer with words like budget and investment.
And the audience doesn't notice the pivot because the vocabulary matches the expectation.
Exactly. Turner is using the adverb "just" to pivot the timeline without the audience noticing.
That is incredibly slick. Okay, let's look at the escalation with the third participant. The performer moves to someone else in the crowd and tells the seated person, "Keep your eyes closed. I'm going to ask you a few questions about your feelings."
The word "feelings" is the linchpin of this entire phase. If we unpack the semantic ambiguity here, "feelings" functions perfectly as both a present tense and a past tense relevant word.
Right. To the audience, "feelings" translates to, "What sensory data are you experiencing right now in this exact moment?"
Exactly.
But to the blindfolded participant, who has been explicitly instructed to remember what they feel, "feelings" means the catalog of past sensations you told me to memorize.
You've got it.
The audience thinks they're downloading live data, while the participant is basically opening a saved file.
Precisely. So the performer is standing next to the third audience member. They raise their hand, tap the audience member twice on the arm, pause, look visibly confused, smile a bit, and then tap them a third time.
It's very theatrical.
Very. They follow this up by holding up two fingers, then three fingers to the audience. It is a very deliberate, confusing visual pantomime. Then the performer addresses the seated person. "Out of interest, when you just felt me tap you, and if you are torn between two numbers, that's fine. Tell me the two numbers. How many times did you feel me tap you?"
This is where my brain broke the first time I read it. Why perform such a messy, ambiguous visual sequence for the audience? Like, why not just tap them three times clearly and ask for the number three?
Because the performer is completely reliant on the secret taps they applied to the shoulder blade back in the setup phase. Remember the exact sequence?
Yeah, two medium taps, one firm tap.
Right. The performer is asking the participant to recall those specific secret taps. But tactile memory, especially of unexpected touches applied while you were trying to concentrate on something else, is notoriously unreliable.
Oh, because they were focused on the ball of light.
Exactly. The participant's memory of that sequence might be muddy. They might only clearly remember the two distinct medium taps and answer two. They might aggregate all the touches and answer three. Or they might feel uncertain about the firm tap and answer two to three.
And the absolute genius is that no matter which of those three answers they give, it perfectly matches the chaotic visual mime the performer just fed to the audience. If they confidently say two, the audience remembers seeing the performer tap twice and pause. If they say three, the audience remembers the final third tap. If they hedge and say two to three, it matches the performer holding up two, then three fingers. It is an impenetrable multiple out strategy.
It is an incredibly robust safety net designed around the limitations of human sensory recall. The audience sees a flawless one-to-one correlation between the bizarre taps they just witnessed and the participant's verbal answer.
The dual reality is holding incredibly strong.
It's locked in.
So the audience is completely hooked at this point. We move into the grand finale, the waking and reinducing. The performer asks the seated participant to open their eyes, shake it off, and take a deep breath. But crucially, the performer does not move from their spot 6 feet away. Do you mind if I ask you a few more questions about your feelings?
Not at all.
When I snap my fingers, reclose your eyes. Snap.
Maintaining the distance during this waking phase is a vital psychological subtlety.
How so?
Well, the audience has just seen something seemingly impossible. Their logical brains are desperately kicking into overdrive, searching for a rational physical explanation.
They want to solve it.
They're looking for thin wires, or a telescoping rod, or a draft of air. By openly waking the participant, illuminating the vast empty space between them, and re-inducing the trance from across the room, you are definitively proving that physical contact is utterly impossible for this final phase.
You're cutting off their escape routes.
You are systematically destroying their last logical defense mechanisms.
The stage is set for the knockout blow. The performer walks up to a fourth audience member. The audience is conditioned now. They know the rhythm of the experiment.
Yeah, they know what to look for.
The performer raises a hand and prods this fourth person firmly behind the left shoulder blade, then throwing their voice across the room to the seated person. The last tap you felt, was it softer or firmer than the taps you felt before?
And the seated participant, reaching back into their internal memory file of those secret touches, remembers the specific sequence. Two medium taps and one firm tap.
Right.
They're being asked to compare the sensations in that file. So they answer truthfully, it was firmer.
The audience hears this and gasps. But the performer doesn't stop there. They deploy what I can only describe as a weaponized sentence. The performer says, obviously you felt me touch you on the forehead and the arm. Can you point to where you felt the last firm tap?
The word obviously is perhaps the most devastating linguistic tool in the entire routine. It is weaponized dismissal.
It's misdirection using vocabulary instead of your hands. Let's analyze how that sentence lands in the two different realities.
Okay, let's do it.
To the seated participant, obviously you felt me touch you on the forehead and the arm means, yeah, obviously I'm acknowledging those overt practice taps I gave you at the very beginning to set the baseline. It makes total logical sense within their timeline.
But consider the audience who's been watching this narrative unfold in real time. They just watched the performer tap the second person on the forehead and the third person on the arm.
Oh, wow.
So when the performer nonchalantly says, obviously you felt me touch you on the forehead and the arm, the audience interprets that as the performer arrogantly, confidently recapping the magical telekinetic taps that just occurred from 6 feet away.
It forces the audience to retroactively solidify the illusion in their own minds. The performer treats the impossible event as an established, boring fact, and the audience accepts it. It sweeps any lingering doubts away.
And then the visual payoff. Can you point to where you felt the last firm tap? The seated participant, remembering that final secret firm tap from the setup, reaches behind them and points directly to their left shoulder blade, which is exactly where the audience just saw the performer firmly prod the fourth participant. The visual convergence of the two realities is flawless.
Turner gives a really specific, almost paranoid piece of physical advice here, too.
He really does.
He says, when the performer is showing the audience where the touch happened on their own body, as an example, you shouldn't just lazily point over your shoulder. He advises reaching over your left shoulder with your right hand to touch the blade, and then bringing your hand down and under your arm to touch it again from the bottom.
Yes. This is to cover all potential visual angles and remove any cognitive dissonance for the audience.
Because people point differently.
Exactly. When you ask the seated participant to point to their own shoulder blade, you don't know exactly how they are going to contort their arm to reach it. They might reach over their shoulder, or they might reach around their ribs and under their armpit.
Right.
If you only demonstrated reaching over the shoulder and they reach under the arm, the visual silhouettes don't match. The audience might subconsciously feel that something is off.
Ah, that tiny bit of friction.
By demonstrating both physical pathways beforehand, no matter which way the seated participant physically points, the visual image perfectly matches a precedent you already set. It is engineered to perfection.
Every possible point of failure has a built-in safety net. It's like a Swiss watch. But Turner doesn't just give you the mechanics, he includes a whole section on setting the scene, which deals with framing the routine before it even begins to maximize the psychological impact.
Framing is everything in mentalism. He mentions that if you have the time to build the atmosphere, instead of just jumping straight into the ball of light induction, you can use a different, more conversational framing.
What's the alternative?
You can introduce the idea that restricting one sense-like sight by closing the eyes, forces the brain to heighten the other senses to compensate.
It's a very credible pseudoscientific premise. Like, most people generally accept the idea that if someone loses their sight, their hearing and sense of touch become vastly more acute.
Sure, it sounds completely plausible.
By leaning into this widely accepted cultural belief, you provide a logical scaffolding for the impossible things you're about to demonstrate.
And as part of this framing, he integrates a psychological force. He has the participant close their eyes, and he says, "I want you to imagine you can see me holding up my hand. Think of the first small number that pops into your mind. This is the amount of fingers I am holding up."
Okay.
The performer holds up three fingers and asks the participant to state their number out loud.
I actually tried this on a few friends after reading the text, and it's eerie how well it works. When you ask someone to think of the first small number that pops into their mind, the vast majority of people will instinctively blurt out the number three. Why is that? Why not two or four?
It comes down to cognitive load and how the human brain categorizes the concept of randomness under pressure.
Okay, break that down for me.
If you ask for a small number, usually between one and five, the brain rapidly evaluates the options.
Mm-hmm.
One and two feel too simple, almost not like choices at all.
Right, they're the start of the scale.
Four feels too even, too constructed. Five feels like the absolute limit of the parameter. Three sits in the exact sweet spot. It feels authentically random, yet immediately accessible.
That is fascinating.
Performers exploit these lazy heuristics of the brain constantly.
So if the performers are holding up three fingers and the participant naturally says three, before you have even started the touching routine, you have created this incredible, surreal moment of genuine telepathy. The audience actually sees the blindfolded person accurately guess the fingers.
Consider what that does to the texture of the rest of the performance. If you hit that psychological force right out of the gate, the entire PK touches routine suddenly possesses immense plausibility.
You're basically softening them up.
You have already proven to the room that a mental connection exists between you and the subject. The audience's defenses are lowered. They are primed to believe.
Right.
The subsequent invisible touches are no longer a magic trick. They are simply a logical escalation of the psychic connection you have already established. It greases the wheels of the illusion.
There is one more piece of framing that I found utterly fascinating, and it happens at the very end of the routine. Turner doesn't just take a triumphant bow and walk off the stage. He actively plays the moment down. He uses this presentation about the phantom limb.
Yes. He addresses the audience and says something to the effect of, "It's interesting how the brain can trick you into imagining you felt something physical, even though there was nothing there."
Like an amputee.
Right. He says, "I always thought it was interesting when someone lost a limb and imagined they could still feel an itch on it months later. I wanted to know what tricked the brain into believing this, and this routine is as close as I got to recreating that phenomenon. It's not perfect, but it's not a bad simulation."
Why on earth would he do that? You just successfully performed a miracle that blew their minds. Why call it a mere simulation and talk about brain tricks? Doesn't that diminish the impact?
It doesn't diminish it. It protects it. This is perhaps one of the most sophisticated aspects of Turner's performance philosophy. It provides a vital out for the logical mind.
How does that protect it?
If you present this purely as supernatural telekinesis or real magic, the cynical minds in the audience, people like that TV producer, will immediately put up their defenses.
Ah, I see.
They will view your performance as a puzzle to be solved, a challenge to defeat. They will start actively looking for the invisible thread, the planted stooge, the hidden earpiece.
Right. They want to beat the magician. It becomes an adversarial relationship.
Exactly. But by offering a pseudoscientific psychological explanation, "I am just tricking their brain into feeling a phantom sensation," you completely disarm that cynical reflex.
You give them a logical conclusion.
You are telling the logical mind, "There is no magic here to debunk. It is just advanced psychology."
Even though that is a complete lie, the psychology is in the linguistics and the timeline manipulation, not in actually inducing phantom touches via suggestion. The touches were real, physical taps. They just happened 2 minutes earlier.
Exactly. But by providing that specific framing, it stops the audience from trying to deconstruct the physical mechanics of the trick. They accept your premise that it was a psychological experiment.
That's incredibly smart.
It elevates the entire performance from a cheap parlor trick into a fascinating, sophisticated exploration of human psychology and the vulnerabilities of the human brain. They walk away pondering the nature of reality and perception, rather than looking for a hidden trap door.
So what does this all mean when we step back and look at it? The Midas Touch is a masterwork of layered deception. The absolute beauty of it is how a few carefully placed secret taps, executed while everyone is distracted by a waving hand, combined with perfectly engineered ambiguous language words like now, just, and feelings, creates this utterly impenetrable illusion.
It is a profound testament to the power of context.
Yes.
You aren't fooling the physical senses of the audience or the participant. You are fooling their interpretation of those senses.
Yes.
You're building two different realities and letting them collide in the minds of the audience.
And Turner knows exactly how potent this collision is, which is why his final piece of advice to the performer is so brilliant.
Oh, the outro advice.
Yeah. He says, when the routine is entirely over, you address the audience one last time and say, no matter how much the participant begs you to tell them what happened while their eyes were closed, never tell them. Intrigue will get the better of them.
Which is a brilliantly manipulative reverse psychology trap.
Total trap.
By commanding the audience to keep the secret, you guarantee two outcomes. First, the audience feels like they are part of an exclusive elite club that knows something the participant doesn't.
Right.
And second, human nature dictates that they will absolutely not be able to keep their mouths shut. They will inevitably rush the participant the second the show is over to talk about it.
And when they talk, their conflicting realities will mesh together, further solidifying the myth of the performance. The audience says, he touched you from across the room. And the participant says, I know, I felt it. And the legend grows.
That is how you secure a reputation that leaves a table of elite mentalists in silence and gets a TV deal out of a hostile producer.
It really is. It leaves us with a profound realization about communication in general. Think about the core concept of dual reality we just explored so deeply. Turner uses it as a precise tool for entertainment, meticulously crafting an illusion on a stage. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with this thought to chew on.
I love this part.
How often in your daily life, in a tense boardroom meeting or in a heated argument with a partner, are two people interpreting the exact same words? Simple, everyday words like now, just, or feelings in completely different ways based on their own internal timelines and emotional contexts.
Wow. It's like we are all constantly experiencing dual realities without even knowing it.
We assume we are communicating clearly because we are using the same vocabulary, but our internal dictionaries are totally different.
Turner uses it to create magic, but dual reality isn't just a mentalist trick. It is happening around you, shaping your conversations and relationships every single day.
That is an incredibly poignant way to look at it. The illusion isn't just on the stage. Sometimes it's in how we understand each other. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of a psychological miracle. Keep looking beneath the surface of the words you hear, and we'll catch you next time.